The Secretary shares the concern of the international community about the security situation in Afghanistan, which is clearly not going in the right direction.
The U.S. government expresses concern for Afghanistan. It's Thursday, the 12th of August, and this is VOA Asia. I'm Ira Melman. Also ahead, we explore who might be helping the Taliban. A harder line from North to South Korea. A hidden tragedy in a place of beauty. Health experts urge President Biden to do more to increase the global supply of coronavirus vaccine. It is all on today's VOA Asia. U.S. officials are now acknowledging that the security situation in Afghanistan is rapidly deteriorating. They say they're working around the clock trying to stop the Taliban violence. VOA's senior diplomatic correspondent Cindy Sain reports.
As the violence in Afghanistan reaches new levels, especially against children, U.S. officials are admitting that the security situation is grim, as U.S. forces prepare to withdraw from the country by the end of this month. John Kirby is the Pentagon spokesman.
The secretary shares the concern of the international community about the security situation in Afghanistan, which is clearly not going in the right direction. The secretary continues to believe that the Afghan forces have the capability, they have the capacity to make a big difference on the battlefield.
Pressed about the fate of the Afghan people after U.S. forces depart, Kirby said the stakes are high.
But this is their country. These are their military forces. These are their provincial capitals, their people to defend. And it's really going to come down to the leadership that they're willing to exude here at this particular moment.
Asked if President Joe Biden is disappointed that Afghan national security forces have not been better able to push back the Taliban, White House Press Secretary Jen Psaki said this.
I don't think we have the luxury of just feeling disappointed. Our view and the president's view is that now is the time for them to utilize the training, the assistance, the security guidance that they have been provided over the last two decades.
One expert told VOA that Biden still has a big decision to make. Michael O'Hanlon is with the Brookings Institution.
Well, the United States now has a big decision to make as to just how hard it's going to try to prevent Taliban takeover of the country. And I think that U.S. air power is the number one swing variable. It's the number one thing we have not yet fully decided that could make a big impact.
At Tuesday's State Department briefing, spokesperson Ned Price also admitted the security situation was deteriorating rapidly, but said Ambassador Zalmay Khalilzad and his team are back in Doha, Qatar, for talks with the Taliban, working around the clock to find a way out of the crisis. Ned Price is the State Department spokesperson.
He will press the Taliban to stop their military offensive and to negotiate a political settlement.
Some experts agreed but warned against high hopes. Scott Warden is with the U.S. Institute of Peace.
So I would not expect a big breakthrough at this, but I think it is an opportunity to put increased pressure onto the Taliban and also to adjust expectations.
The decision on any potential last-ditch efforts by America to prevent a Taliban takeover of Afghanistan rests squarely on the shoulders of the U.S. Commander-in-Chief, President Biden. Cindy Sain, VOA News.
Taliban fighters took control of another city in northern Afghanistan Wednesday, an official said. The eighth provincial capital to fall to the insurgents in 6 days as U.S.-led foreign forces complete their withdrawal. Joining us on VOA Asia from Kabul is Aisha Tanzim, VOA's bureau chief in Afghanistan and Pakistan. Aisha, how much territory has the Taliban taken in Afghanistan?
The latest that we have is that the Taliban have taken over 9 provincial capitals. They started on Friday, and as we have been reporting, and by yesterday, they took over the 9th capital. And after that, now they're in full control of the entire northeast and a large part of the north of the country. So the situation is becoming dire. There are only one or two provincial capitals left in the north, one of them that the Taliban have attacked or tried to take over multiple times is Mazar-e-Sharif. On Sunday, Mazar was in panic because the Taliban said they were attacking, but they couldn't manage it. They were stopped 20 kilometers from the city. So today, President Ghani is in Mazar-e-Sharif along with warlord and the highest ranking military official in Afghanistan, Marshal Abdur-Rashid Dostum. What he's trying to do is to stop this momentum of Taliban by drumming up support among old warlords who can mobilize people into what they're calling locally as public uprising forces. We need to remember that in Herat, it was one old warlord, Ismail Khan, who managed to stop the onslaught of Taliban. Yes, he was helped by ANDSF, but he's the one who took the lead. So if these public uprising forces organize, and if the old warlords manage to mobilize them, it could be definitely a boost for the Afghan defense and security forces.
There have been some reports that some high-ranking military officials, at least one, has been replaced already, and some news that was apparently leaked that said it might be within the next 6 to 9 months that the Taliban could take Kabul. What do you hear about these bits of information?
Yes, I have reached out to some sources to find out what they think about this this story. I think Reuters filed it, which said that the Taliban can take over Kabul in a couple of months. I think the general perception around here is that, yes, that is one of the scenarios, but that is the worst case scenario, which is if everything goes south, if everything falls apart. It is not a foregone conclusion, and there is a possibility that the Afghan army can get its act together, that the warlords realize it's an urgent situation, President Ghani realizes it's an urgent situation, and they put aside their political differences, which have been around for years, and in this region, political differences among warlords and the central government have been the norm for like centuries. So they put aside their political differences, come together, and they can hold their ground. So yes, that is a scenario, but the worst case scenario. As for the changing the leadership, yes, President Ghani has changed the army chief. He's taken someone who was catching flak for not delivering, and he took the head of the special forces, and special forces has been the most successful part of the Afghan defense forces against the Taliban, and he took the head of special forces and now put him in charge of the army.
Is anybody helping the Taliban? There are reports that Al-Qaeda is contributing and maybe some other countries.
We know from UN reports that Taliban have not broken ties to Al-Qaeda. It'll be very difficult for Taliban to break ties with Al-Qaeda because their relationship goes back four decades, and it's not just a military relationship. Over the four decades, these people have intermarried. They are now linked with ties of relationships in blood and also friendships, fighting in the trenches together. So on the ground, is Al-Qaeda helping Taliban? There's a very high likelihood that its fighters are. Is it helping strategizing? Afghan government is also leveling allegations against neighboring Pakistan and saying that a lot of new jihadists are coming in over the borders from Pakistan. We also know that some dead bodies were received in Pakistan and were buried there of fighters from Afghanistan. What is unclear so far is whether these new jihadists that are coming over, whether they have the support of the government or whether the government even knows about them crossing the border, because Afghanistan-Pakistan border has been porous for a very long time, and these jihadist links go back decades. The Taliban, a lot of them are former students of madrasas in Pakistan. In the 1980s, when the jihad started against the Soviet Union at the time, a lot of these people were trained in Pakistan, were given education in madrasas in Pakistan at that time with support of the United States and some other countries. So what the ties that developed there were never broken, and they continue to this day. So we know of reports of fundraising in other parts of the region, Pakistan included. There are some reports of Iran helping the Taliban, or at least allegations by some in the Afghan government and, like, you know, casual chats. This region is very complicated. There are a lot of formal channels of support, and there are lots of informal channels of support. Like, money comes here from Middle East because Taliban subscribe to a very strict brand of Islam, similar to Saudi Arabia, for example. So the resources are coming from all over, and it's very hard to identify for each offensive where exactly the help came from. I mean, that's part of the problem in this region.
Aisha Tanzim is the VOA bureau chief for Afghanistan and Pakistan. She's been a very, very busy person over the past few months, and we thank you so much for being with us, Aisha.
Thank you for having me.
We're happy you're with us on VOA Asia. North Korea on Wednesday said South Korea and the United States missed a chance to improve relations and are risking a serious security crisis by choosing to escalate tensions as they conduct joint military drills. Flora Bradley Watson reports.
North Korea has accused the U.S. and South Korea of risking a serious security crisis by conducting joint military drills. In a statement carried by state media on Wednesday, senior official Kim Yong-chol said Washington and Seoul were responding to Pyongyang's goodwill with hostile acts. He singled out Seoul for what he said was a missed opportunity to improve inter-Korean relations by going ahead with the exercises. In the statement, he said the South must be made to, quote, clearly understand how dearly they have to pay for choosing their alliance with Washington over peace between the Koreas. Kim previously played a leading role during historic summits between North Korean leader Kim Jong-un and former U.S. President Donald Trump. His comments come a day after the powerful sister of North Korea's leader warned about the military drills. For a second day in a row, North Korea also did not answer routine calls on inter-Korean hotlines. The phone lines were only reconnected at the end of July, more than a year after the North severed them amid rising tensions. The South and the U.S. began preliminary training on Tuesday and start wider-scale computer simulations next week.
Reuters' Flora Bradley Watson reporting. This is VOA Asia. I'm Ira Melman. The Washington Post reports that more than 175 public health experts, scientists, and activists have sent a letter to U.S. President Joe Biden urging him to do more to increase the global supply of coronavirus vaccines to stop the emergence of more contagious variants. The signatories called on President Biden to announce an ambitious global vaccine manufacturing program within the next 30 days, saying such a plan is the only way to control this pandemic, protect the precious gains made to date, and build vaccine infrastructure for the future. More police are being sent to Sydney's COVID-19 hotspots as Delta variant cases continue to surge in Australia's biggest city. From Sydney, Phil Mercer reports.
With Australia's two biggest cities, Sydney and Melbourne, in lockdown, Prime Minister Scott Morrison says the situation is dire.
We are in a tough, tough fight with this Delta strain.
A senior state government minister in New South Wales, Australia's most populous state, has said a lack of compliance in some migrant-heavy neighbourhoods has made the outbreak worse. About three quarters of New South Wales state's nearly 5,000 active cases come from nine Sydney local government districts in the city's west, where many migrants live. On Wednesday, officials reported 344 new COVID-19 cases and two more deaths, including a man in his 30s. Brad Hazzard, the New South Wales Health Minister, says some areas of Sydney with large immigrant populations continue to ignore the regulations. Only 23% of Australians are fully inoculated. Authorities say that figure needs to be 80% before life can start to return to normal. Phil Mercer for VOA News, Sydney.
Thank you for joining us. Thank you to our service chief, Diane Gao. Our VOA Asia team includes Jim Stevenson, Keith Lane, Amy Heibels, Chris Cascao, and Doug Bernard. I'm Ira Melman. Stay safe and enjoy the day ahead.